You open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
Storytelling is the second oldest profession in the world. We have an advantage over the first oldest profession. You can do it to a lot of people at once.
Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. On today's program, historical fiction writer Diana Gabaldon talks about her best-selling Outlander series. She says she got the idea to set the books in 18th century Scotland after watching an old episode of the TV show Doctor Who, in which the Doctor picks up a young Scotsman during one of his time-traveling adventures.
And this was a 17, 18-year-old young man who appeared in his kilt. And I said, well, that's fetching. So that's where I began, knowing nothing about Scotland or the 18th century, having no plot, no outline, and no characters. Nothing but the rather vague images conjured up by the notion of a man in a kilt, which, as you will all admit, is a very powerful and compelling image.
Diana Gabaldon's 8-book Outlander series has sold more than 20 million copies, and a TV show based on the series premieres on the Starz Network on August 9, 2014. Guest host and executive director of the Great Lakes Independent Booksellers Association, Deb Leonard, asked Gabaldon when the 9th book would be coming out.
Let's put it this way. I finished writing Moby on April 15th, having stayed up for 36 hours straight to do so. I then spent the next 2 weeks doing the copy editing and proofreading galleys, working 16 hours a day to do so. I then spent the month, my husband took me to Disneyland for 3 days to decompress after that. But then I spent the rest of May doing everything that I had not been doing for the preceding 6 months while finishing the book. And on June the 7th, I left home to do things like this every night. As in when people come up and say, well, how far along are you on book 9? The answer is, do I look like I'm home writing it? Thrilled to come and spend time with you, but you have a choice. You can have the next book sooner, or you can look at me. Are you looking at me? No, I have never been able to describe my books in 25 words or less. The closest anyone has come is a nice reviewer named Gavin McNatt from Salon.com magazine, who said, this is the smartest historical romance adventure science fiction story ever penned by a science PhD with a background in scripting Scrooge McDuck comic books. I couldn't do a lot better than that. I have, however, seen my books so far being sold as literature, fiction, science fiction, historical nonfiction. This is true. Now, I was in Foyle's bookstore in London and saw my books in the history section. And I called the clerk's attention to this, and he said, well, Miss Kitty Foyle, who was about 92 at the time, but still kicking, said, Miss Kitty decides where everything in the store goes. She's read your books, and I believe she believes in time travel. So let's see. So historical fiction, history. Let's see. We did science fiction, fantasy, mystery, romance, gay and lesbian fiction, military history, and horror. Now, this is true. I won a Quill Award in 2006 in the category science fiction, fantasy, and horror. What was cool about it was that I beat both George R.R. Martin and Stephen King. Yeah. Thank you. Is there anything else you would like to know about my books?
Well, just on the off chance that there are people here who haven't read them, you can give a broad outline of kind of how it starts. How it starts, that's all I say.
Right, okay. Well, 90-second sales pitch. In 1946, right after World War II, a British ex-combat nurse named Claire Randall goes to the Scottish Islands on a second honeymoon. Now, she and her husband have been separated for 6 years by the war. He's been in the Army, she's been in the Army. And they're getting to know each other again, thinking of starting a family. But one day, while her husband is busy, she goes out walking by herself and finds a small circle of standing stones, which in fact are all over the British Isles. She walks through this circle and disappears back into 1743, where the first person she meets is a gentleman in an 18th century army officer's uniform who looks just like her husband and turns out, in fact, to be his 6 times great-grandfather. Unfortunately, he also turns out to be a sadistic bisexual pervert. And And while trying to get away from him, she falls into the hands of a gang of Scots who are also trying to get away from him for other reasons. And finding an English woman roaming around where no English woman should be. In the 18th century, the highlands of Scotland were like wildest Borneo. No one went there except the army because they had to. So finding an English woman roaming around in what looks to them like her underwear, because she's wearing a 1940s house dress, they scoop her up and take her back to their castle to find out who and what she is. Well, the wicked Captain Randall also wants to know who and what she is and demands that they turn her over to him. Since the Scots are well aware of what this man is capable of, they don't want to do that. Also, they do want to find out who she is for their own purposes. So they don't want to hand her over, but the only way they can think of not handing her over is to force her to marry one of the young clansmen in order to become a Scottish citizen and thus not subject to legal constraints by an English garrison commander. So they force her to marry a young man called Jamie Fraser. Yes, I made a bet with one of the organizers as to how many pocket Jamies there are in the crowd tonight. So Claire finds herself in this invidious situation. She's held prisoner, essentially, in a castle with a bunch of Scots. She's trying to escape from them and get back to the Stone Circle and back to her husband. Meanwhile, she's falling in love with the young man that she's been obliged to marry, and the wicked Captain Randall is hunting them both. The story unrolls from there.
That's pretty good. You mentioned earlier that you have a science background, that you have a BS in zoology,
I do.
A master's in marine biology,
I
and
do.
A PhD, I'll have to read this one, in quantitative behavioral ecology.
That's just animal behavior with a lot of statistics. Don't worry about it.
I don't think that's a background that most novelists have. Can you kind of tell us how you got from there to here?
Well, you'd be surprised. Most novelists make their own way. There isn't really a well-marked pathway for becoming a novelist. It's not like being a lawyer or a CPA. You don't take classes and get a certificate and being you're a novelist. Most people work it out for themselves. I have a good friend named Ian Rankin, a well-known Scottish crime novelist, whose biographical information says that he had many careers before starting to write fiction, including tax collector and swineherd. I asked him once how this happened exactly. How did you get to be a swineherd, and you know, why did you quit? And he said, well, in his younger years, he and his wife were domestic servants on a small French vineyard estate. His wife did the domestic chores, and he took care of the outdoor stuff, including slopping the pigs. He said it was a traditional outfit, which meant that when harvest time came, everyone stripped naked and stomped the grapes and, you know, drank wine all weekend and passed out. And after one of these bacchanals, he woke up from a stupor and realized that he hadn't fed the pigs. So he took one of the tubs of, you know, smashed grape skins and so forth and threw it into their trough. However, he didn't think that the grapes had been fermenting in the sun for several hours, and the pigs all died of alcohol poisoning, which was the end of his career as a swineherd. But it may explain a few of the things you'll read in his fiction. Yeah. Anyway, as I say, everyone comes to this in their own way. For me, I knew since I was 8 or so that I was meant to be a novelist. I just didn't know how. And I came from a very conservative family background. My father was fond of saying to me, well, you're such a poor judge of character, you're bound to marry some bum, he said. So be sure you get a good education so you can support your children. So with this in mind, I thought I would not announce that I wanted to write books for a living, knowing that this was an iffy proposition. And instead, I went into science. I liked science. I was good at it. I enjoyed research. I liked teaching. But I knew I was supposed to be a novelist. And when I turned 35, I said to myself, well, you know, Mozart was dead at 36. Maybe you better get a move on here. I said, okay, on my next birthday, I will begin writing a novel, just to learn how. It's not for publication, not going to tell anyone what I'm doing. I just need to know what it takes to write a novel. Because up to this point, I had written a lot of everything, all the stuff you have to write in the process of getting a PhD, and all of the stuff you get while being a university professor. So I'd written, you know, everything from a 400-page doctoral dissertation entitled Nest Site Selection in the Pinion Jay, Gymnorhinus cyanocephalus. Or as my husband says, why birds build nests where they do and who cares anyway. up to scholarly articles and textbooks and documentation and grant proposals, and also anything anyone would pay me for. Because while I did not marry a bum, I married a very nice man whom I still have 42 years later. But, thank you. Thanks. Thanks. He did quit work 3 months after our first child was born in order to start his own business. And I do have to say that in terms of financial stability, there's not that much to choose between an entrepreneur and a bum. So for the first several years, while his business was getting its feet under it, I was our sole support, and we kept having children. I had to learn a way of making extra money without taking up prostitution in the home. I once told a writer's workshop, I said, writing, storytelling is the second oldest profession in the world. I said, we have an advantage over the first oldest profession. If you're a writer, you can do it to a lot of people at once. It's a little neater as well. But anyway, I had written a lot of stuff to this point. I knew I could handle nonfiction. The question was, what could I write that someone would pay me for? Well, here I must digress for a moment, and there is a reason why I write long books. It's because I like digressions. But I was hired at the university without a job description, because I went to interview and they said, well, the legislature has given us this money for this position. If we don't hire someone, they'll take it away again, so you're hired. I said, we don't actually have anything for you to do, but we'd like you to design your own research program. And while you're doing that, perhaps you could help Bob here, the assistant director, with his data. They said, Bob has 10 years worth of data in cardboard boxes in his back office. They said, you have a computer background, by which they meant I had one class in Fortran programming, but it was one class more than any of them had. And they said, so you can help Bob get his data into the computer. This was the early 1980s when they still thought you unscrewed the top and shook the data into it. So I said, fine, and spent the next 18 months of my life writing Fortran programs to analyze the contents of bird gizzards. That's what Bob did. Anyway, the upshot of this was a 800-page monograph entitled The Dietary Habits of the Birds of the Colorado River Valley, and an expertise in Fortran programming for scientific purposes. And the upshot of this was that I ended up founding a scholarly journal at my university called Science Software Quarterly for scientists who used computers in their work. And so when the need came to earn extra money, what I did was write a brief query letter to the editors of Byte and InfoWorld and PC Magazine, and enclosed with it my Science Software Quarterly journal and a comic book that I'd written for Walt Disney entitled Nutrition Adventures with Orange Bird. And it was a very short letter. It said, Dear Sirs, as you can see from the enclosed, you won't find anyone who knows more about scientific and technical software than I do, and at the same time can write so as to appeal to a broad popular audience. Well, this got immediate results, and within a year I was making as much freelancing for the computer press as I was at the university, which just goes to show how badly they pay assistant professors. But anyway, the point here is that I knew how to write almost anything, but not because anyone told me. I had just looked at a couple of examples and then wrote one, and if it didn't look quite right, I poked it till it did. So when I thought it's time to write a novel, my first response was, well, you've been reading novels for 30-odd years. If you write one, surely you will recognize it. So I said, okay, I can write a novel. I said, I just need to know what does it take in terms of mental commitment and daily discipline and organization and research to write something like a novel. Also, I had not written any fiction before other than comic books, which are arguably fiction. And so I said, well, I'm just going to start. So I said, okay, what kind of book shall I write? Because, it didn't matter. I wasn't going to show it to anyone. I could write anything. I said, well, I read everything and lots of it, but maybe more mysteries than anything else. Maybe I should write a mystery. I said, no, mysteries have plots. I'm not sure I can do that. I said, what's the easiest possible book I could write for practice? And I thought, well, perhaps for me, historical fiction. I was a research professor. I knew my way around a library. I said, it seems easier to look things up than to make them up. And if I turn out to have no imagination, I can steal things from the historical record, which actually works pretty well. And so I said, fine, historical fiction. Where shall I set this? Because I've got no background in history, just the 6 hours of Western civilization they make you take as an undergrad. And so one time would do as well as another. I'd have to look it all up anyway. So I was casting around for a convenient time and place in which to set this novel, and I happened to see a really old Doctor Who rerun on public television. Who is your favorite doctor? I like David Tennant myself. Chris Eccleston was good, but he only lasted one season. For those of you who are not either cheering or giggling, Doctor Who is a really old, really long-running show done in the UK, where it was originally done as a fantasy show for kids, but has become much more adult and watchable. The premise of the show, though, is, I think it's watchable. The premise of the show is that the Doctor of the title is a Time Lord from the planet Gallifrey, who travels through space and time, having adventures, and along the way, he picks up companions from different periods of Earth's history. And in this very old show, which has to have been done 50 years ago, he had picked up a young Scotsman from 1745. And this was a 17, 18-year-old young man who appeared in his kilt. And I said, well, that's fetching. I found myself still thinking about this the next day. In church, and I said, well, you know, you want to write a book, it doesn't really matter where you set it, the important thing is pick a point, get started. So I said, fine, Scotland, 18th century. So that's where I began, knowing nothing about Scotland or the 18th century, having no plot, no outline, and no characters. Nothing but the rather vague images conjured up by the notion of a man in a kilt. Which, as you will all admit, is a very powerful and compelling image. It's actually one of the organizers was telling me she had seen a man in the kilt, you know, standing in the line, so we may actually have one on the premises. Yeah. You may regret that, sir. Yes, I mentioned the Quill Award that I'd won earlier. That was for Breath of Snow and Ashes, which is a very lucky book. Oh, thanks. Yeah, and it not only won me several awards, it opened at number one on the bestseller lists of the U.S., Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And I'm really pleased and happy, and I thank you very much, that Moby has done the same thing. Thanks. Thank you very much. Yeah, I appreciate it very much. But the second award that Breath of Snow and Ashes won was the Corina International Prize for Fiction, which was very cool, and I got to go to Germany to accept this on Bavarian television, an adventure in itself. But while I was there, the German publisher had me interviewed by everyone in the German press, you know, one after another, every half hour for a week. And at the end of this, I was sort of cross-eyed, but still answering questions. And I was talking to a nice gentleman from a literary magazine, and he said, oh, I've read all of your work. He said, you know, your imagery is just magical. Your characters are so three-dimensional. Your narrative drive is tremendous. And I'm thinking, yes, go on. And instead, he paused and said, there's just this one thing I wonder. Can you explain to me what is the appeal of a man in a kilt? Well, he was a German, you know, but anyway. I was very tired, or I might not have said it, but I just looked at him and I said, well, I suppose it's the idea that you could be up against a wall with him in a minute. Yeah, I, yeah, I told that story to Sam Hewen and he turned white. Then he turned red, and then he started wearing his kilt everywhere. But 3 weeks after this excursion, I got a packet of press clippings. I was back home, and that one was on top. I recognized the interviewer's name, but the German publisher had put a post-it note on top in English that said, I don't know what you told this man, but I think he is in love with you. So, you know, very powerful and compelling image, as I say. So that's where I began. I went to the library the next day and began looking up Scotland in the 18th century. Now, all I knew about writing novels was that they should have conflict, so that's what I was looking for. Well, you don't look for conflict in Scotland in the 18th century for very long without running smack into Bonnie Prince Charlie and the Jacobites. And I said, okay, that looks like conflict, fine. I said, now I must have a lot of Scotsmen, of course, because of the kilt factor. But I think it would be a good idea if I had a female character to play off these guys. That's tension, that's sex, you know, that's conflict, that's good. And so I said, since it looks like it was Scots versus the English, if I make her an English woman, we will have lots of conflict. So the third day of writing, I introduced this English woman. No idea who she was, how she got in the plot, what she was doing there, but I loosed her into a cottage full of Scotsmen to see what she'd do. Well, they were all crouched around the hearth muttering, and they turned around and stared at her when she came in. And I was thinking, why does she look funny? What's going on? And one of them drew himself up, and he said, "My name's Dougal Mackenzie, and who might you be?" And without my stopping to think, I just typed, "My name's Claire Elizabeth Beecham, and who the hell are you?" And I said, "Well, you don't sound at all like an 18th century person." So I fought with her for several pages, trying to beat her into shape and make her talk like a historical person. She wasn't having any. She just kept making smart-ass modern remarks. And she also took over and started telling the story herself. And so I said, "Well, I'm not going to fight with you all the way through this book." And I said, "No one's ever going to read it. It doesn't matter what bizarre thing I do. Go ahead and be modern. I'll figure out how you got there later." So it's all her fault that there is time travel in these books. So that's how, yeah.
Your novels are, as you say, big, fat historical fiction, usually about 900 to 1,000 pages. Now, when you start a new one, do you just fire up the computer and say, "Okay, chapter one, here we go"? What's your writing process?
No, not like that at all. Often people say, "Oh, do you do this? Do you do that?" And so forth. And usually the answer is no, it doesn't work like that. I don't outline books. I don't plan books out before I write them. I don't work with an outline. I don't work in a straight line. I work in little bits and pieces where I can see things happening. What I need to write on any given day is what I call a kernel, a very vivid image, a line of dialogue, an emotional ambiance, anything that I can sense very concretely. If I can, then I will sit down and write a line or two describing whatever it is. Then I sit there and stare at it. I take words out and I put words back and I move clauses around. And I'm trying to make that line as euphonious and clear as I can. And all the time, the back of my mind is kicking up questions. You know, what time of day is it? How is the light falling? What's going on here? And, you know, gradually it begins to grow one way and another. I'll do it for you in a minute. You have to see how it works. It's very hard to describe to people. But I develop a scene around this kernel. Sometimes the kernel disappears in the writing. The kernel is never the point of the scene. It's just how I get words on the page to start. And then I go backwards and forwards as I'm writing through this scene. It's very, very slow, the way I work. But I'm fiddling and changing and moving things and dropping things out and putting them back. And I will have been through a scene literally hundreds of times by the time it's done. But it is done. It's the best I can make it. And at that point, I will leave it and go look for another kernel. Sometimes I know what happens next, and I'll write that. In the early stages, I never do. So I just look, you know, through my historical references until something occurs to me. Or, you know, I pick up some idea that's come to me through the day, and we start there. Now, on one of these occasions, what I call a cold day, that's a day where you sit down and you're thinking, "I knew how to write yesterday, but I have no clue today." this totally happens to all writers, believe me. On one of those days, I said, "Well, you know, I need a kernel somewhere. Nothing's occurring to me." So I picked up a Sotheby's catalog of 18th century Scottish crystal and silver. And I said, "Well, everything in here is demonstrably 18th century Scottish, so anything in here will do." So I picked out a nice goblet. It was a crystal goblet with thistles incised in its sides. And I said, "Okay, that looks Scottish enough, fine. We'll describe this goblet just as a means of getting words on the page." So I'm saying, and I'm thinking, as I usually do, "How is the light falling?" So I'm saying, "The light fell through the crystal goblet." Yes, I need to say it's crystal because I'm going to see that. Do I need to say through the crystal thistle-incised goblet? That doesn't make any sense. That's too many adjectives. No. "The light is falling through. The light fell through. The light is falling. The light fell through." We're in somebody else's head. They'd be using the past tense. The light fell through the crystal goblet. Well, just leave it alone for the time being. Do I need to say goblet? Could it be glass? No, it needs to be goblet. So the crystal, we need crystal. "The light fell through the crystal goblet, and, well, what did it do next? Well, it's crystal, dummy. It fell through it. It fell on the floor." I mean, no, it's not the floor. I can see it. It's a table. Well, of course it is. Why would it be sitting on the floor? The light...
But there's something about that light. It's a very distinct kind of light. I can see it. It's blue. It's got that blue tinge to it. It's winter light. Okay, it's the winter. I'm seeing what you see at about 3 p.m. on a winter afternoon. So, okay, the low blue light of winter afternoon, of a late winter afternoon. That's too many adjectives, but keep it for now. The low blue light of a late winter afternoon fell through the crystal goblet and fell onto the table. That lands with a thud. You need something else. And fell, but I can see the light. It's making a pool of light. Well, of course it is. It's the glass is not leaking. It's the light. The low blue light of a late winter afternoon, that's not too bad, fell through the crystal goblet, making a pool of amber light. I can see it making a pool of amber light, amber pool of light, making an amber pool of light on the polished wood of the tabletop. I can see it. It's just gleaming like that. And I said, okay, now I know where I am. I'm in Jocasta Cameron's parlor. She's the only person in this story who would have glass windows. They have to be glass because otherwise I couldn't see the winter light coming in. And would also have a polished wood table, a crystal glass full of whiskey. That's why the light is amber. The glass is full of whiskey. And so I'm sitting there thinking, well, it's winter. You know, is the room cold? And I'm thinking, yes, it is. My fingers are cold. So is the end of my nose. But my feet are warm. There's a fire. Whereas at the wire is over there. Oh, there's a dog by the fire. I've never seen him before. That's how.
Now, you've talked before about how being a scientist is not very different from being a writer at all, a novelist at all. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, people assume, you know, that being a scientist is this very cold, clinical, tidy, linear, orderly kind of thing, and being a novelist is this very creative, colorful, warm, touchy-feely kind of thing. Which is not entirely true. You can actually have warm, feely science, and you can certainly have cold, clinical writing. But the thing is that both those things are both different sides of the same coin. What both processes rest on is the ability to discern patterns and bring them out of chaos. When you're a scientist, you define your chaos by the kind of organism or system that you choose to study. And when you're a novelist, say, you define your chaos by the subject that you choose. In my case, I chose 18th century Scotland. So that, you know, meant I was not going to be writing about rocket ships and things like that. It cut out a lot of stuff. But there was plenty of chaos left in 18th century Scotland to deal with. When you're doing art, you use your own internal chaos, though. You use your life experience and your background and your own prejudices and, you know, what you've seen of the world and so forth. No, you use this in a scientific context too, but it tends to be more the observations that you've made and the experiences of other people who have worked in this field. But again, you're bringing in all of this outside stuff into this delimited chaos. Well, in science, you then make a hypothesis. You said, I think I see this pattern. I think I see what's going on here. So I'm going to say, if this is what's happening, then I would expect this and this and this. And then you can proceed to test those and see whether it's right or not. When you do art of any kind, your novel or your sculpture or your painting is your hypothesis. That's your test. And you test it by unloosing it on the public and seeing what happens.
That's very good. Are any of your children writers?
Oh, are any of my children writers? Yes, actually all of them are in one way or another. Our eldest daughter is an operating room nurse, and she says, I'm not a good fiction writer. She says, if you give me a real story, I can tell the hell out of it. She says, but you know, I'm not good at making things up. But in fact, she's written a really charming memoir of her nursing training and her first year as a nurse, which has an agent at the moment. We'll see how it does. Our son is a published novelist himself. He writes epic fantasy, which is extremely gory but very funny. And his fourth book will be out in the fall. It's called The City Stained Red. You may look out for it. Yeah. His name is Sam Sykes is what he writes under. We gave all the kids my husband's name, which is Watkins, because it's so much easier to pronounce and spell. Yeah. My actual name is a Spanish name, and were we speaking Spanish, it would be pronounced Gabaldon, hence the long O in the last syllable. You know, Watkins is just easier all around. And it rhymes with bad to the bone, is what I always tell people. Anyway, my son chose to use my mother's maiden name because it would get him a better shelf position. So he writes as as Sam Sykes, so you can look out for that. Now, the little one is married to a nice young Scotsman and lives in Edinburgh. And nothing. Yeah, it actually has not one single thing to do with my books. None of my children read my books, as my eldest daughter says. I don't want to read sex scenes written by my mother. And it is, in fact, pure coincidence that our younger daughter's name is Jenny and that she married a man named Ian. But they do live in Scotland, and Jenny is the accounts manager for social media for a Scottish marketing firm, which means we don't know what she does, but they pay her a lot of money to do it. But she is writing historical fiction on the side, and, you know, has not quite got up to the stage where she feels ready to look for an agent, but she has written a whole book and is revising it, so she's pretty good, too.
So do any of your kids write as you do?
Oh, do any of my kids write as I do? Well, Jenny writes historical fiction, but it is not at all in my style or my voice. What's rather eerie is that Sam does. Well, he's never read any of my books. I have read his, and, you know, he will send me things to back up, and I'll skim through them and so forth. What's odd is that he has my sense of pacing. He'll break a paragraph exactly where I would break it. He'll, you know, do a hyperbolic paragraph that's, you know, just on the verge of being too purple, and then undercut it with a one-liner exactly the way I would do it. He puts in, you know, narrative and dialogue alternating exactly with the same pacing I do. You could, if you were not looking at the words, put up a page of my text and a page of his, and, you know, just looking at the outline of the margins, you would think it was written by the same person. Triumph of genetics.
All right, this is one I've been dying to ask. James Alexander Malcolm Mackenzie Fraser. Did he? He's one of the best romantic heroes ever, right? I think he is the best, but. Did he spring fully formed out of your imagination, or did you have to work on him a little bit?
The other reason my children don't read my books is that they know, because their friends read my books, that Jamie Fraser is very tall with red hair, and so is their father. And I did mention that I had been married to this man for 42 years. There's a reason for that. No, my husband did not read my first book until after I had sold it, and it came back as a bound galley, and at which point I gave it to him to read. It was halfway through, and he said, "Well, this is a great story." He said, "I'm loving it." He said, "I can't help noticing that this hero of yours is very tall with red hair." And I said, "Well, it's true. You're Jamie Fraser's body model from the neck down." And, he said, "Oh, good. Now the whole world knows on page 323 what I look like with no clothes on." I said, "Well, it's all right. He's lying on his face in that scene." Jamie is his own person. In fact, he is endowed with a lot of my traits. But there's no denying that he is physically, you know, very much like my husband, or at least like my husband was at that age. And my husband is still in very good shape, but he is a year older than I am. And I'm 62, if you were trying to figure it out. But my husband does share his sense of humor with Jamie to a strong extent, and he also just occasionally comes up with really good lines. He accuses me of stealing all his best jokes for Jamie, which is true. But you know, 1 year, maybe 20 years ago, he was just reading the Wall Street Journal one morning, and he looked up at me and said, perfectly conversationally, he said, "You know, when I die, if my last words aren't 'I love you,' you'll know it was because I didn't have time."
Golly.
Well, that's what I said, too. But anyway, that's where the last line of Fiery Cross came from.
That was nice. You also have a really interesting way of talking about the kinds of characters that you deal with in your books. That'd be interesting.
Yeah. Well, to me, characters are either onions, mushrooms, or hard nuts, which sounds like an exotic recipe for turkey stuffing. But an onion is a character whose essence I apprehend immediately. I know who these people are in their heart and soul from the very beginning. But the more I work with them, the more pungent and rounded they get, and the more layers they develop as we have more experiences. And Jamie and Claire are both onions. Mushrooms are those people who just pop up out of nowhere. I didn't plan them. I wasn't expecting them. They just appear and immediately walk off with any scene they're in. And Lord John Grey is one of my best mushrooms. Thank you. And a hard nut is somebody that I'm kind of stuck with, either for structural reasons of the plot. For instance, Clara is pregnant at the end of the second book. Obviously, there is a kid in the next book, and this is not anybody, you know, that that developed organically. I was just stuck with her, had to decide, you know, who is she, and at what age are we going to experience her, and what is her background, and, you know, what's she like, given that I know who her parents are, but kids don't always grow up like their parents. And the other kind of hard nut is the real historical person, Bonnie Prince Charlie or George Washington, for instance, whom you have to animate for your fictional purposes. And to do that, it's a little more of a straightforward job in that you research them. You find things that they wrote to try to determine not only how they talked, but what their attitudes were, what their means of using language was, and, you know, what were their concerns, what were they likely to have said in this situation or that. But it's not like developing a fictional character where you just get to know them and see what they do.
Well. Okay, I've waited long enough. We have to talk about the miniseries now.
Well, it's not a miniseries. It's a regular TV show, which, with any luck, will continue for years and years.
It premieres August 9th on Starz, in case you don't have that in your calendar yet. And since the first book, since Outlander was published in 1991?
That's right.
I'm sure your fans are like, well, it's about time. But why do you think it took so long?
Oh, why did it take so long? Well, partly because people kept trying to make a movie out of it. And people kept saying, well, I want to see a movie made of your book. And I want it to be just like it is in the book. And I'd say, well, great, which 40 pages do you want to see? And, because, as I now know from hard experience, you cannot get that book into a two-hour movie. There is no way of making a movie that would resemble the original story in any way, shape, or form. The book has a very intricate underlying skeleton. All the pieces are connected. You start pulling pieces of it out, you don't have anything left. And we, over the years, have optioned the books only four times, though we've had, you know, constant inquiries about it, especially as the books became bestsellers. But the way an option works is that a production company will come and offer you a modest amount of money for a period of time. What they get is a year, 2 years, maybe five, whatever you agree on, during which they have the sole right to try to raise enough money to put together what they need for a movie, to attach a director, get actors, you know, get a whole production going. If they can do that, then the contract provides for them to pay you a larger amount of money, which is the purchase price. If they get to that stage, they actually own it, and they own it forever. You'll never get it back, no matter what they do with it. So you want to trust them insofar as it's possible to use the word trust in the same phrase with filmmaker, which it isn't always. But anyway, we were very careful who we dealt with. And as I said, we had it optioned three times before the most recent one. And this was done by a man named Jim Kohlberg, who had actually made a few movies on his own, small ones, but very critically acclaimed. He had read the book four times before coming to talk to me, and in the middle of negotiations called up to tell me he thought he was channeling Murtaugh. So we got along. I trusted Jim. And so we signed an option agreement with him. Well, he, like everyone else, wanted to make a two-hour feature film of it. Well, to this end, he hired, you know, very respectable screenwriters whose names you would recognize if I were indiscreet enough to speak them aloud. But and he showed me the scripts. This is why I know it's not possible to make a two-hour movie. These were horrible. Horrible. One of them appeared to be the wastebasket outtakes from Braveheart, strung together in sort of a cartoon fashion, punctuated by 20-page speeches about freedom, which is so not what the Jacobite Revolution was about. It wasn't a revolution, it was a rebellion. But anyway, the other one was written by a respectable person had written a film that I actually liked, but her take on it was that Claire was, and I quote, a sexy wild child, you know, who going around some kicking up her skirts in the village pub and so forth. I was sort of going, yeah. And after Claire goes through the stones, the first thing that happens is a man charges by on a horse and falls off wounded at her feet. I'm thinking, yes, okay. Well, what does this, you know, competent, capable ex-combat nurse do? Does she fall to her knees and go look for his pulse? Does she, you know, stanch the spurting artery? No, she throws her hands in the air and runs off shouting, help, help! I'm thinking...
No.
No. No. Fortunately, none of these came to anything. Well, meanwhile, unbeknownst to me, Ron D. Moore, who was the creator of, or the recreator of Battlestar Galactica and the showrunner of this very successful thing. I bet it's all the Doctor Who people who know who Ron D. Moore was. But anyway, very respectable in science fiction and fantasy filmmaking circles. Anyway, he had finished Battlestar Galactica and was looking for another, you know, engrossing project. And he was having dinner with his wife and his production partner and mentioning this. And one of them said, well, what about Outlander? Have you read that? And the other one said, Outlander? You read Outlander? And they started doing what Outlander fans do when they meet each other. And he was looking back and forth between them. And he said, well, do you have a can you give me a copy of this book? And they both whipped one out of their bags. And so he took it home, read it all in one night, and said, yes, yeah, okay, we got something here. So he went to see who had the rights, which was Jim. And he approached Jim about, you know, collaborating on a TV show. And Jim was saying, no, I want to make a two-hour film of it. So Ron kept coming back, you know, every 6 to 8 months and so forth. And about the fourth time, he was saying, well, how's that two-hour film working out for you, Jim? Jim said, I begin to think you're right. It may be a TV show. So at that point, we got down to brass tacks. This is the first that I'd heard of Ron's interest. But there ensued 2 years of negotiations, which finally resulted in this really, really complicated five-sided contract between Sony, which is the overall company that owns the international distribution rights, Starz, which is the production company that is actually making the show and thus has the distribution rights in the U.S., Ron, Jim, and me. So this took a long time to get going, but here we are.
I don't want to ask you how many times people said, you get to pick who Jamie is. But did you get to have any say in?
Well, I am, by the terms of the contract, a consultant. And usually this just means it's a way of giving you extra money without them having to account for it. But it doesn't actually amount to anything. They don't really want you to consult. And in this instance, though, they did. Part of this is owing to you. One reason that Starz wanted this property is because of its enormous and enthusiastic fan base. And thank you. So a lot of this is your doing. But the last thing they want is for me to get up in front of said fan base and say, oh, they're screwing it all up. I hate this. You know, they don't want that. Consequently, they've been extremely nice about including me. And part of it is just that Ron and his partner, Merrill, are in fact very nice people. And they came out to talk to me before the contracts were finalized and before they did the pitch of their first script. And they spent 2 days at my house, you know, talking through the characters, the storylines, the backstory, you know, how I saw things, what I saw in the future, and so forth, and explaining to me also their own ideas of adaptation and, you know, how you would do things slightly differently for visual mediums and you know, what they thought they might do. For instance, Ron said at one point, he said, you know, the book begins rather slowly, and he said, you can do that in a book because the prose will carry people along. He said, you can't do that in a TV show or a motion picture. You need to rivet people's attention immediately so they don't change the channel. They said, you know, this story is obviously centered on Claire. We need to know who she is immediately and feel, you know, instant empathy with her. He said, so what I would like to do is a two-minute visual prologue where we show her during World War II in a French military hospital, you know, blood spurting, limbs coming off, you know, putting people back together and being who she is. And I was saying, yeah. So, and we got along. We were on the same wavelength. And I approved of his ideas, and as I told him, he gave me his first script before he took it to pitch to Starz to see what I would say. And I said, you know, this is the first thing I've ever read based on my work that did not make me turn white or burst into flame. So we actually get along very well. But they send me scripts to read and comment on, and they show me footage from the show, and you know, they ask me my opinion. They're under no legal compulsion to take it, but they do pay attention to what I say. And they usually will, you know, if I say, I think there's a real problem with this particular thing, and that's very uncommon. I really like what they're doing, and mostly I just say, yeah, this is great. You know, every once in a while there's some little quibble in one script where Jenny is having a baby. There's a howl from the bedroom, and someone says to her husband, it sounds like your wife's giving birth to a piano. And I wrote back and said they didn't have pianos in the 18th century. So they changed it, and I just saw that in the footage, and now he says, it sounds like your wife's giving birth to a harpsichord. So, you know, it's mostly just very trivial little things like that. But you know, if I have a real problem, they will accommodate it one way or another. They don't invariably, you know, take it out or whatever. Sometimes they'll just, you know, twist it around so that it's acceptable. But you know, we get along very well. So I'm very happy with what they've been doing, and I think you will be too.
Did you get to be involved in any casting decisions, and how do you feel about the people that they've cast?
Oh, casting decisions and so forth. Well, I actually had nothing direct to do with the casting. That would not be in my purview. But when they began their casting, you know, obviously the main characters are Jamie and Claire. And they were thinking, well, Claire, you know, there's dozens of, you know, really good British actresses. Surely we can find one without too much trouble. So she'll probably be the first thing. And Jamie, you know, how are we ever going to find the king of men, as Ron calls him? And, you know, this will just take forever, but, you know, I'm sure we'll find one. It'll be the UPS man or something. But so they had just barely begun looking, and I was driving with my husband from Phoenix to Santa Fe and had stopped in Flagstaff, and I got this call from Ron and Merrill, and they said, oh, we're so excited, we found Jamie. And I said, really, you have? You're kidding. They said, no, we can't believe it either, but we're pretty sure. We're sending you his audition tapes to look at. And I said, oh, great, you know, I can't look at them really until I get to where we're going tonight, but great, what's his name? And they told me it's Sam Heughan, spelled it for me. So I was Googling Sam Heughan on my iPhone as I was driving with my husband, or he was driving, I was Googling, and I was looking at his IMDb page. Now, Sam is a very chameleonic actor. He looks totally different in every single one of his parts. And in fact, I wrote to him after having spent considerable time with him in LA and Scotland. I said, you know, having, you know, now been in your presence for a real long period of time, I still have no idea what you actually look like. I said, I have a real strong sense of your physical vibe, though. Yeah, no, my husband actually went with me to Scotland. We spent 10 days with everybody on set watching that. And in fact, I did a small cameo with them. I got to be a TV actor for 2 days, which was fun. Yeah, but they had a nice dinner for us at the end, which is where my husband actually, he'd met Sam before, but this is the first time he'd spent much time in his company. Afterward, he said, you know, that Sam Heughan is a big sucker. He's got his own gravitational field. I said, well, he's exactly the same height you are, but he weighs 40 pounds more. But anyway, so I was not sure what to expect. I was looking at these photos, and I was thinking, this guy looks grotesque. What are you thinking? You know. But we got there, and so I booted up my computer, and I'm sort of looking through my fingers because I'm not sure what I'm going to see. And 5 seconds in, I'm thinking, well, he doesn't look anything like his photos. He looks fine. Then 5 seconds more, he was gone, and it was just Jamie Fraser right there. And I was going, yeah, yeah. Just totally gobsmacked, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, no, he was a fabulous actor, really, really good. And so then the search went on for Claire and so forth. They cast any number of smaller parts and so forth, which they didn't show me. But finally, at the very last minute, they came up with Katrina Balfe, this lovely Irish actress who just is Claire. As I said, we looked at dozens of really good British actresses, but none of them was Claire. And then Katrina had actually done a self-tape, and they said, we think she made it on her iPhone. You know, she just set it up with a timer and then dashed into shot. And she said she, you know, didn't have a casting director or anything, so it was a cold read, but there was something about her. And when they couldn't find a Claire anywhere, they had kind of gone back to the casting company and said, well, send us all the people you rejected. Let's look at everything again. And so all the Starz people looked at everything again over a weekend, and they all came back. Every single one of them said, well, there's this one, you know, there's something about her. And each one of them had picked Katrina, and they said, no. So they called her back in to do a more formal reading, and then they made poor old Sam fly from London to L.A. to test with her. It's an 11-hour flight. He told me I flew for 11 hours, did the test in 1 hour, flew back to London, and then had to go directly to the makeup studio to have the prostheses for my back fitted. And he said that took 7 hours. At the end of this, I was just standing in the parking lot because they'd screwed up my cab. I was left alone there, you know, about to pass out. So, yeah, he suffers for his art, yeah. But anyway, I saw that audition, that joint audition between them. It was just fabulous. You know, they just struck sparks off each other immediately, and they've just done a wonderful job together.
Great. So are you going to get to do any script writing?
Oh, I'm going to do any script writing. Well, Ron asked, was I interested in doing a script? And I said, well, not for the first season, certainly. For one thing, I'm not a team player. I'm used to having total control over everything I do. And this is not how script writing works. It's very much a communal enterprise. I said, you know, having met the screenwriters and so forth and got along with them, I said, yeah, I would like to consider it in the future, maybe. But I don't want to do it in the first season because I don't want to be responsible for screwing something up. You know, when the success of the first season predicates whether we get another one. And I said, also, I was still finishing Moby, and I said, you know, I have to finish this book, and then there will be all the touring and so forth. I just will not have a free moment for, you know, about 9 months, and during which time you will be doing all of your script writing and filming and so forth. So I said, if you get a second season, we'll talk about it.
You've been writing about these characters for over 25 years. Mm-hmm. Are you tired of them?
Am I tired of them? No. Well, bear in mind, I have been married to the same man for 42 years, too. I don't get bored easily.
So we know there'll be one more book at least, but you're not making us a
promise. Yeah, I don't plan the books out ahead of time, so I never know how many books there are. But I do know there's 9th because I wasn't through telling the story at the end of Moby.
Great. How many books did you write before you actually got to Scotland? And were you really happy that it was like you had portrayed it?
Outlander is the only book I wrote purely from library research because I was not telling anyone what I was doing, including my husband. I couldn't really announce that I needed to go to Scotland for several months to do research. So I did that, and also, you know, it was for practice. But we sold it, and they gave me a 3-book contract, and so I said to my husband, well, I think we really must go and see it. So we did, and spent 2 weeks driving around the Highlands and exploring. I had a wonderful time, and I acquired a much better Gaelic dictionary on my trip. And, you know, it was really great. But it was, in fact, exactly as I had been imagining it, which was a good thing on the whole. But really, the only thing that you can't find out from research is what a place smells like, because they don't put that in the tourist brochures. So I know what Scotland smells like from personal experience. It's got a very distinct smell.
Well, it's funny that you said that, because we've been talking the last couple of days, and I said, you know, I think it was such a great plot device to have Claire's background be as it was, not just a combat nurse, but her having the childhood, having been kind of dragged hither and yon by her uncle, so she was in very primitive situations, and she was used to not having hot showers or things smelling really weird for a while, or squishy things. So I always thought that was a great device, too, so I think you've just done brilliantly.
Well, thank you very much.
That.
Appreciate it.
You can see I'm as big a fan as you guys are. As a matter of fact, I couldn't say yes fast enough when they asked me to do this, and I've been like,
well, I'm very flattered. Thank you so much.
What else have I asked you? What else do you want to talk about that I haven't asked you?
Oh, let me see. There are a few other things in the works besides book 9. There is a prequel volume about Jamie Fraser's parents. Well, I'm kind of looking forward to that one. That one started the idea for it some years ago when someone approached me with the idea of writing a novella for one of those joint books that have 4 authors writing on a common theme. And I said, well, I don't know. My contracts all say that Random House has the option on my next book. I don't know if this qualifies as book or not, but let me call my editor and ask. So I did, and she said, oh, well, that sounds interesting. What were you planning to do for them? I said, well, I thought maybe I would write 3 linked novellas, one about when Red Jacob died and Colum and Dougal took over the clan. And I said, then how their sister escaped from them and how she eloped with Black Brian and they got married, and then about Murtaugh and how he became Jamie's godfather. And so I told her that, and she said, oh, you can't do that for me, for them. I lust for that story. You have to do it for me. I said, well, you don't publish novellas. And she said, oh, I'm sure you could make it longer. So we are at last, I think, at the point where I can write that. So that's in the works. Oh, and you will get the 2nd volume of The Outlandish Companion fairly soon.
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah, I actually work on multiple projects at a time because it keeps me from ever having writer's block. You know, if something's not working, I just shift. And so nonfiction, you never have writer's block because you can always work on nonfiction. It's like my daughter said, if they have the story already, you can tell the hell out of it. But and nonfiction is like that. So I have been sort of working along on the second volume of The Outlandish Companion for the last 3 or 4 years, and it's almost complete. I need a few other things like the detailed synopsis for Moby, which isn't written yet, and a couple of articles. But most of it is there, so I'm hoping to be able to deliver it to the publisher, you know, in the early spring, and after that it's up to them when they publish it, but I'm hoping you'll get it early next year. Yeah, there is also an ebook, which is completely written, but I need to show it to my agent and, you know, discuss a few technical issues and so forth. But it is called How to and How Not to Write Sex Scenes.
Your children won't be reading that, I assume.
Yeah, it makes good reading. Yeah, so let's see. I think that's probably about it. You know, and there's other little novellas and things floating around in my mind, but those are the principal things that I'd be working on. Oh, I do have a contemporary crime novel, because back when I said I thought I would write a mystery, but I wasn't sure if I could do plots. Well, now I'm reasonably sure I can do plots. And when we'd finished the first 3 books that were under contract, I told my agent, well, there is another one, Drums of Autumn. And he said, well, they'll be pleased to hear that, since the previous one had hit the New York Times list. And I said, well, great. I said, you know, I want to write a mystery, but I know publishers don't like you to stop doing what's selling and do something else. I said, so tell them that they can have Drums of Autumn, but only if they'll give me a contract to write a mystery, too. This may be our only chance to blackmail them into it. And so they thought about it, and they said, all right, we'll give you a contract for 2 mysteries, and then if the first one succeeds, we'll have another series going. So I've had that contract for over 15 years, and they're not breathing down my neck about it, but I have half that book finished, too, and it's, you know, floating higher toward the top of my pile, so, and it's, you know, shorter than most of the others, so somewhere along in there that'll pop up, too. Oh, and there will be at least one more Lord John novel, so.
I forgot to ask you, which of your characters intrigue you?
Which of my characters intrigue me the most?
Intrigue you the most. Which ones?
Oh, they pretty much all do. They're fascinating. People always ask me, you know, well, how much of you is in Claire? To which the answer is 15.3%. And, you know, really, Jamie has much more of me in terms of, you know, spirituality and his sense of family and, you know, tribal organization and responsibility and all that. But there is a fan group in Phoenix who take me out for tea every spring to pick my brains about a book. And on one of these occasions, they got started on the character of Black Jack Randall. And they're going, oh, he's so loathsome. He's such scum. He makes my skin crawl. And I'm sitting there sipping my tea and thinking, you have no idea you're talking to Black Jack Randall, do you? Yeah, I mean, they're all me. Who else would they be?
Well, it seems like you have a particular affection for Lord John.
Oh, yeah, I like Lord John very much. As I say, he's a mushroom. He just popped up out of nowhere, and he walked off with things. And the thing about him is that being who he is, you know, totally honorable gentleman, aristocrat, you know, brave soldier, but he's gay in a time when that was a capital offense. That means that he lives chronically with constant conflict or the possibility of it, and that means that any situation you put him in will be interesting just because of who and what he is.
Have you ever had people talk about the Outlander novels as feminist?
Have I heard people talk about the Outlander
novels
as feminist?
Because Claire's such a very strong female character. She, you know, doesn't really take a lot of guff.
No, people say, oh, you write such strong women, and I say, well, I don't like stupid ones. And I don't think anyone's ever described them as feminist as such. In fact, feminists usually jump up and down and froth at the mouth because of the infamous wife-beating scene in Outlander.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, wait till you see that on the show. People ask Ron, you know, what are you going to do about scenes like this and that? And he said, if it's in the book, we'll show it the way it is in the book. And they did. No, it's a great scene. Yeah, they did it perfectly. Yeah, no, that scene is one of my favorites because it illustrates so perfectly the cultural clash going on. I mean, from Claire's point of view, she is totally justified in what she did. She was trying to, you know, get back to the Stone Circle, back to Frank. This might be her only chance, that she knew where she was. She could, you know, more or less see the Stone Circle. And if she didn't leave then, she might never be able to make it. So she left. It wasn't her fault, as far as she's concerned, that she then got captured by Captain Randall, causing, you know, everybody to have to come and rescue her and thus be in danger. Well, from Jamie's point of view, he's totally justified, too. She disobeyed his orders, ran off, and got all of them into hideous danger. Now he's being, you know, even more closely pursued by Captain Randall, who knows he's in the neighborhood. And she's just put all of their lives in danger, and the entire clan that's with her are furious with her because of this. Well, he's her husband. You know, it's his job, you know, to kind of restore her to the clan, so to speak, by, you know, punishing her, you know, making it clear that you've done wrong, you know. And so that's what he feels obliged to do. He also knows if he doesn't do it, his Uncle Dougal will. So anyway, he's going to do it, you know, come hell or high water. She, of course, being a 20th century woman, has major issues with this. But as I say, you know, both of them are totally justified in their particular points of view, but those views are diametrically opposed. You know, they're just complete butting of heads. And when push comes to shove, he outweighs her by 80 pounds. You know, he's going to win.
I think that's wonderful. We could have you read a little bit from your book.
Sure,
if you like that.
I'd love to. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, we will hope my Kindle is still working, but it should be. It was charged up when I left home. All right. Well, now, I know a lot of you have not actually read Moby as yet, and I also know how sensitive people are about spoilers, so we are going to read a piece that cannot possibly spoil anything for anybody. I hope it doesn't shock any of you, but somebody said, oh, if you're going to read spoilers, a non-spoiler thing, you know, they wouldn't even remember it when they got to the book. I said, they'll remember this one. What little background you need to know is we left William at the end of the last book, having just discovered that he is not the 9th Earl of Ellesmere, as he's been assuming, but the illegitimate son of a Scottish criminal. And this obviously has stirred him up quite a bit. Well, the British Army is getting ready to pull out of Philadelphia. He goes out with some of his friends and, you know, gets stinking drunk, ends up in a whorehouse, you know, sort of passed out, not intending to do anything. He just went with his friends. But while he's there, he becomes slowly aware that a man near him, another soldier, is telling a friend of his in extremely crude and disgusting terms what he's planning to do to one of the whores there. And this is a young woman that William had met briefly a few days before and had a rather difficult interview with. And anyway, he would like to make up for that. Anyway, he's still very drunk. Anyway, he gets up, you know, and says, I'll take that one, you know, for the night, only then realizing that he has no money, and whips off his silver gorget and hands it over in payment, thus, you know, really pissing off the other soldier. Anyway, he then goes upstairs with this girl, who's a little wary of him, but is certainly thinks he's the lesser of two evils. And when they get there, he announces that he doesn't want to have sex with her, and she's astonished. And he said, no, my father, meaning Lord John, once told me that the best gift you could give a whore was a good night's sleep. She says, you mean me to sleep? He says, I don't really care if you stand on your head or not, but I'm not having sex with you. And so anyway, there's this slightly awkward business. Anyway, she gets into bed, and he stretches out in a chair, you know, trying to go to sleep. Anyway, there was a prolonged moment filled with the unspoken thoughts of two people, then a deep, exasperated sigh. Come and get into bed, you idiot. He couldn't get into bed in full uniform. He did keep his shirt on, with some idea of preserving her modesty and his original intent. He lay quite rigid beside her, trying to envision himself as the tomb figure of a crusader, a marble monument to noble behavior, sworn to a chastity enforced by his stone embodiment. Unfortunately, it was a rather small bed, and William was rather large. And Arabella Jane wasn't trying at all to avoid touching him. Granted, she wasn't trying to arouse him either, but her mere presence did that without half trying. He was intensely aware of every inch of his body and which of them were in contact with hers. He could smell her hair, a faint scent of soap mingled with the sweetness of tobacco smoke. Her breath was sweet, too, with the smell of burnt rum, and he wanted to taste it in her mouth, share the lingering stickiness. He closed his eyes and swallowed. Only the fact that he needed desperately to pee made it possible to keep his hands off her. He was in that state of drunkenness where he could perceive a problem but could not analyze a solution to it. And sheer inability to think of two things at once prevented him either speaking to her or laying a hand on hers. "What's the matter?" she whispered hoarsely. "You're wiggling like you've got tadpoles in your drawers." "Only you haven't any drawers on, have you?" She giggled, and her breath tickled his ear. He groaned softly. "Here now," her voice took on a tone of alarm, and she sat up in bed, twisting round to look at him. "You're not going to be sick in my bed. Get up right this minute." She pushed at him with small, urgent hands, and he stumbled out of bed, swaying and clutching at furniture to keep from falling. The window gaped before him, open to the night, a lovely sickle moon pale above. Taking this as the celestial invitation it surely was, he raised his shirt, gripped the window frame, and pissed into the night in a majestically arching rush of blinding bliss. The sense of relief was so intense that he noticed nothing whatever in its wake until Arabella Jane seized him by the arm and pulled him away from the window. "Get out of sight, for God's sake." She risked a hasty glance downward, then dodged back, shaking her head. "Oh, well, it's not as though Captain Harkness was ever going to propose you for membership in his favorite club, is it?" "Harkness?" William swayed toward the window, blinking. There was a remarkable amount of shouting and abuse coming from below. But he was having trouble in focusing his eyes and perceived nothing save the flicker of red uniforms, redder still in the light from the lantern over the establishment's door. "Never mind. He'll likely think I did it," Arabella Jane said, a dark note in her voice. "You're a girl," William pointed out logically. "You couldn't piss out a window." "Not without making a prime spectacle of myself, no," she agreed. "But 'tisn't unknown for a whore to throw the contents of her chamber pot out on someone, accidental on purpose." "Well," she shrugged, went behind the screen, and emerged with the aforementioned receptacle, which she promptly upended out the open window. In response to renewed howls from below, she leaned out and shrieked several insults that a regimental sergeant would have been proud to author, before ducking back in and banging the shutters closed. "May as well be hanged, or buggered, for a sheep as a lamb," she remarked, taking him by the arm again. "Come back to bed." "It's only in Scotland that they bugger sheep," William said, obediently following her. "And maybe part of Yorkshire." "Northumbria, too, maybe." "Oh, really? Is Captain Harkness from one of those places, then?" "Oh, him?" William sat down on the bed rather suddenly as the room had begun to revolve in a stately manner around him. "No, I'd say maybe Devon, from his speech," he concluded, pleased to have found the word. "So they've got sheep in Devon, too, then, I suppose." Arabella Jane was unbuttoning his shirt. He raised a hand to stop her, wondered why he should, and left the hand hanging in midair. "A lot of sheep," he said. "A lot of sheep everywhere in England." "God save the Queen, then," she murmured. Intent on her work. The last button came free, and a faint draft of air stirred the hairs on William's chest. He remembered then why he should have been stopping her. But she'd put her head inside the open front of his shirt and licked his nipple before he could make his arrested hand complete its motion. And when he did, it merely settled gently on her head, which was surprisingly warm. So was her breath. So was her hand, which had wrapped itself around his prick in a possessive sort of way. "No," he said, after what seemed a very long time, but could have been no more than seconds. His hand descended and closed, regretfully, over hers where it grasped him. I meant it. I won't bother you." She didn't let go, but did sit up and regard him with an air of puzzled impatience, just visible in the lantern light that seeped through the shutters. "If you bother me, I'll tell you to stop. How's that?" she offered. "No," he repeated. He was concentrating fiercely now. It seemed exceedingly important that she understand. "Honor. It's my honor." She made a small sound that might have been impatience or amusement. "Maybe you should have considered your honor before you came to a whorehouse." "Or did someone drag you inside against your will?" "I came with a friend," he said with dignity. She still hadn't let go, but couldn't move her hand, not with his clasped tightly round it. "That's not what I mean. I mean..." The words that had come easily a moment before had slipped away again, leaving him blank. "You could tell me later, once you've had a good think," she suggested. And he was startled to discover that she had two hands and knew what to do with the other one, too. "Unhand my... damn, what is the bloody word? Unhand my testicles, if you please, madam." "Just as you like," she replied crisply, and doing so, put her head back inside his damp, smelly shirt, seized one nipple between her teeth, and sucked so hard it pulled every last word out of his head. Matters thereafter were unsettled, but largely pleasant, though at one point he found himself rearing above her, sweat dripping from his face onto her breasts, muttering, "I'm a bastard, I'm a bastard." "I'm a bastard, don't you understand?" She didn't reply to this, but stretched up a long white arm, cupped her hand round the back of his head, and pulled him down again. That's why. He came gradually to himself, aware that he was talking, and evidently had been for some time, in spite of his head being cradled in the curve of her shoulder, his senses a swim in her musk. Like a sweating flower, he thought dreamily, and her nipple a dark sweet thing, an inch or two from his nose. The only honor I have left is my word. I have to keep it. Then tears came suddenly to his eyes with recollection of the moments just past. Why did you make me break my word? She didn't answer for a while, and he would have thought she'd fallen asleep, save for the hand that roved over his bare back, gentle as a whisper. Ever think that maybe a whore has a sense of honor, too? She said at last. Frankly, he hadn't, and opened his mouth to say so, but once more his words had gone missing. He closed his eyes and fell asleep on her breast. Appreciate that very much.
Yes, yes. We have time for a few questions from the audience.
How are we going to do this? Microphone.
You can pick.
Oh, I get to pick. Oh, yeah. Lady in the front then.
I'm just wondering how you acquired such a wonderful vocabulary.
How did I acquire one, such a wonderful vocabulary? I come from many generations of notorious word drunks. Yeah. No, our family had a gigantic Merriam-Webster Third International Dictionary, and my sister and I would browse it for fun. Mm-hmm. Yes, gentleman in the second row there.
I was just curious about the addition of Jenny Fraser's middle name, one of them.
Janet Fraser or Ellen?
Janet.
Oh, what's her middle name?
Katrina?
Oh, that's Ellen, Jamie's mother. It's her middle name.
Oh, okay, because that one, I mean, that seemed to pop up.
Uh-huh. Moby. Well, I asked the copy editor, I said, have I ever said what Jamie's mother's middle names are? And she checked and said no, and I said, okay, this is what they are, for inclusion in the family tree, and it's also on her tombstone in one of the later scenes. Yeah. But yes, that was a compliment to a friend, and you will find Mr. Hewen somewhere in there, too.
Yes, my name is Susan. I'm from Petoskey, which is about 60 miles from here. Mm-hmm. And my sister, my mother, and who's now dearly departed but is here tonight in spirit, loved your books.
Thank you so much.
And my question is, with the development of the characters, and they come in and out of play as time, how do you keep track of all of those?
Well, people often say, you know, how do you remember all your characters? And I say, well, how do you know the guy you woke up with this morning is your husband, you know? You live with them, you know? And, you know, I see stories as shapes. When I've written a scene, it has a distinct shape to me, and as it joins up with other scenes, it makes a bigger chunk. And gradually, I line up several big chunks against a rough kind of timeline that I'm developing in the back of my head. And at that point, if we're all lucky, I see the overall shape of the story. So I can kind of see who needs to come in here or there. And, you know, I'm carrying in my head what happened to them because I've been living through whatever happened to them with them. So whenever another piece of their life drops into place, you know, it's just as though it's part of my life. Of course, you know, I frequently don't remember what I did last Tuesday, and that's why copy editors are useful. But thank you. Let's see. Is there someone toward the back there that you can reach with your mic? Yeah, lady in the green.
Hi, my name's Jennifer. I'm from Miami, Florida, by way of Indiana. I'm kind of curious. George R.R. Martin has said that he knows how Game of Thrones, his series, is going to end. Do you know how your series is going to end? Do you have that in your mind?
Oh, do I know how my series is going to end? No, I don't. George kind of has to because, as he said, the producers of his show, they're breathing down my neck. As in, they've filmed 4 seasons and he's only got 5 books. I have 8 books and they have not even finished filming the first one. I have plenty of time. Yeah. Let me see. Is there any? But
is there a question upstairs?
Let's see. Can we answer the gentleman standing in the balcony if we can? Yeah. How did I get to North Carolina? That's what happened in history. That's where people went after Culloden. The Highlanders who left Scotland, half of them those who went to the New World, and most of them did, some of them were transported to the sugar plantations in the Caribbean, but those who went voluntarily, half of them went up the coast to Prince Edward Island and Nova Scotia. The other half headed up the Cape Fear River into the mountains of North Carolina and Tennessee. So I just went with them. Yeah. Okay, and how about over there, as whoever's closest to you?
Hi, my name's Marianne. I'm from Wixom, Michigan. And I just wondered, out of the times you visited Scotland so far, what is the most favorite place you've seen or an attraction you visited that you've just, that's really, you know, struck you that you've really liked seeing?
Well, I don't know if liking is the right word, but it would be Culloden Field. You know, that's a very, very haunted place. Yeah. No, literally, I have been there a number of times, and I at one point knew the curator fairly well, and was having tea with him there, and he said, I live in the visitor's center. I've got my own apartment off the back. He said, it's equipped with motion-detecting lights and so forth. It's a national battlefield and so forth, and he said, at least once a month, I'll be sitting there after dinner, reading a book or something, and I will hear footsteps running up the path to my my door, and someone will pound on the door, frantically, so seeking entrance. And he said, and I'll always go and answer, but there's nobody there, and the lights haven't come on. But I'd say that. Yeah, okay, let's see. How about you in the middle, if you can stand up? I'll repeat your question.
I read somewhere that when you write a scene, you try to incorporate three different senses. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, she says she's heard that when I write a scene, I try to include three different senses. Can I elaborate on that? Well, yeah, it's sort of the rule of three. If you use three senses, it creates a sense of three-dimensionality, of immediacy and vividness to a scene. Now, most the majority of writers are only using sight and sound. You know, she looked like this, she said that, he said that, and so forth. But they're not, if you're writing a certain style of book, you may have sex scenes in which touch comes into it, but in that case, they usually drop out all the dialogue. So it's just, touch and sight and, the occasional gasp. But see if I can find a little bit in what I just read that would illustrate that. Let's see. He could smell her hair, a faint scent of soap mingled with the sweetness of tobacco smoke. Her breath was sweet, too, with the smell of burnt rum, and he wanted to taste it in her mouth, share the lingering stickiness. Okay, are you not only smelling it, but also sensing the taste of rum and the sticky feel of it? So we've got touch, taste, and smell all going on in that paragraph. Is this vivid? Yes, it is. He closed his eyes and swallowed, in case you were. Yeah, like that. Yeah, over here.
Hi there. I'm wondering, do your characters ever appear in your dreams while you're sleeping, or do any of your storylines ever develop while you're sleeping?
Oh, do my characters appear in my dreams or my storylines develop while I'm sleeping? No, never. No, everything that I am thinking about them comes out in the writing. I write in the middle of the night, so by the time I go to bed at 4:30 in the morning, it's gone. It's empty. there's nothing there about that. I do dream, but not about them. Okay, let's see. Lady in the white here in the front.
My name's Jan from Mount Pleasant. And you talked about onions and mushrooms and hard nuts.
Yes. Oh, have I ever had a mushroom pop up and have nothing to do with them? And if so, what do I do with them? They never work that way. Mushrooms pop up, in a situation. And the situation is peculiar to them. But, after that, they're established. And after that, I can sort of move them around, so to speak, or have them appear in other inclinations. But no, they never just appear without context. I mean, Mr. Willoughby, the little Chinese man in Voyager, was a mushroom. He just popped up out of nowhere, and I kind of knew who he was when he popped up. But then I sort of worked with him a little bit, figuring out who he was. And what gave him more of his context was a book that I picked up at about that time off a remainder table called The Sex Life of the Foot and Shoe. just about foot fetishism and so forth, and it had a chapter on bound feet, and how bound feet work. You take a little girl and you bend her toes under, bandage them very tightly, and then you bend her foot farther and under her heel, and gradually the toes rot and fall off, and eventually what you're left with is that. Okay, what are you looking at? In case you were wondering why anyone would do that, because they're perverts, that's why.
We have a question upstairs.
Yes, up there.
I'm Janelle. I'm from Traverse City. So
Hi.
Welcome to Traverse City. I was just wondering, when your characters die, are you sad about that? Do you see that coming and you're like, oh no, they just died, and then you can't do anything about it? And you're like,
oh yeah, yeah. No, it's very upsetting when they die. You know, sometimes I know ahead of time, sometimes it's very sudden. You know, I wasn't expecting Rupert to die, but that was terribly upsetting, but you know, there he was. Yeah, no, I mean, there's a strong sense of inevitability about it when they do die, and it's very upsetting. And you know, I write those scenes with tears streaming down my face, as with others, you know. People always say, well, you know, do you find writing emotional scenes emotional? Well, yeah. What do you think? Yeah. Anybody over on that side? We haven't been over there very much. There's a lady. Yeah, go ahead.
I just wondered, what made you think to start your second book 20 years later?
Oh, what made me start Dragonfly and Amber 20 years later and then do most of it as a flashback? Well, it had to do with the hard nut, you know, the daughter, Brianna, and so forth. I thought it would be kind of boring for them to have to drag this little kid back and forth and through Culloden and so forth. And I was thinking, you know, we can't have, you know, these passionate scenes of farewell and so forth. If you've got this little kid, like, hey, what are you doing, Mommy? No, I mean, kids are fine in their context. I adore my children, but by and large, they're a big bore, you know. So I said, let's just start with her as an adult, you know, shall we? And then she'll be more interesting. So that's what I did. Yeah. Yes, lady here in the front.
Hi, I'm Judy from Grayling.
Judy? Uh-huh.
As your brain is tumbling around, trying to sort out how you're going to do things, how did you mesh Claire's 20th century medicine so seamlessly with 18th century Scotland?
How did I measure 20th century medicine with 18th century Scotland?
Yeah, that was really cool.
Well, thank you. Well, thanks, but you know, it wasn't technically difficult. It was told through Claire's point of view. You know, she brought her medical knowledge with her, and so naturally she would apply that.
What? How did you know what it was?
Oh, how did I know what it was? Research. Well, that, and I, through another academic accident, ended up teaching a class called Human Anatomy and Physiology repeatedly. Which is where I got her broad but shallow grasp of clinical medicine. And, you know, whenever I needed to do anything more invasive, you might say, it's really easy to find out how you do medical procedures. And by this time, I have a number of doctors that I can pass things past. With anesthesia, yeah. Well, I mean, they had whiskey. And what they mostly had was restraining straps. You know, they would strap people down and, you know, just do it with them conscious. You know, and she'll do that on occasion. She doesn't like to. Which is why she invented ether or reinvented ether. Yeah, anybody else in the top there? Who's the microphone near? There's a lady behind you to your right. Yeah.
Hi, Melissa. And I was just wondering why you chose to have Roger be so tormented.
Oh, why did I choose to have Roger be so tormented? He's just that kind of guy. Yeah, you know, I don't make these people up, you know, they just sort of evolve. Yeah, no, up there too, there's a lady in the sort of sparkly top that's standing up, yeah.
Thank you. Have you ever come up with a wonderful death scene and then had to create a character and a story and gone backwards with it?
No, never. She's asking, have I ever come up with a wonderful death scene and then had to create a character to die? No, it doesn't work that way. Not for me. Lady here on that side.
Hi, I'm Jessica from Fayetteville, North Carolina.
Hi, and, Jessica.
Jamie and Claire have such a beautiful marriage that I wanted to know if their relationship in the books has affected your relationship, or is it really more vice versa?
Well, has Jamie and Claire's relationship affected my relationship with my husband, or is it vice versa? It's sort of the same thing. When I finished writing Outlander, which I wrote for practice, not intending to show it to anyone, but as I got toward the end, I had got an agent, and I told him I thought I should stop while I could still lift it, but there is more to the story. Now, I don't like to do the same things that I've already done, and so I wasn't going to, you know, start over with another courtship story and that sort of stuff. And I said, you know, there's a lot of books that are centered around courtships, both, you know, romance and more mainstream literary stuff. Love stories are, you know, very popular, and for good reason. It's a really strong cultural archetype. I said, but it's reasonably apparent why that is. You know, it's a deeply instinctive drive, but also it's really easy to do in terms of structure and so forth. And that's why everybody does it. And, you know, people who write genre romance, essentially, they're not writing the same book repeatedly, but that's why it's accused of being formulaic, is because they are all courtship stories, and the courtship is over when the couple come together, either in bed or the altar, and preferably the reverse. But I said, it seems to me much more interesting to see what makes people stay married for 50 years. And I've never seen anyone try that in a literary context. So I said, well, I think I'll try that.
It's wonderfully done. Thank you.
Yeah, now, do we have a microphone near anybody up there? Or do you just want to stand up and yell?
I'll just use my teacher voice.
Good, thank you. Do I myself like Scottish whiskey? Actually, I do. I had never drunk it when I began writing, and in fact, I didn't at all. I'd never tasted it until Voyager. That was the first time the publisher had ever sent me on a book tour. And at one of the stops, someone gave me a quite large bottle of something called Glenroth single malt. And I said, well, you know, in the interest of research, I should at least try it, what it's like. Yeah. So I decided that I liked it, you know, and sipped my way carefully through that bottle, and then went on to explore other things. The moment I've got a nice bottle of Hockentotion that Ron Moore gave me for Christmas, that's what got me through the last part of Moby. Thanks. Is there anyone over toward that wall that we haven't done?
Two more questions.
Okay. Yeah, let's get one of the people who's over in that section. They have been neglected a bit.
Do you speak Gaelic, and if yes, would you please?
Do I speak Gaelic, and if I do, would I please? I don't. It's a very difficult language. I have the kind assistance of several native Gaelic speakers who help me with it, though. I do have three bits that I put in people's books. Well, actually, there's four. And you will find some of these in your books, undoubtedly, if you stay for personal signing and so on. Limish, which means with respect or best wishes. Slancha, which is what you say when drinking whiskey, it means to your good health. You either say slancha or slancha va, if you really mean it. Or it's good whiskey. And albacopra, which means Scotland forever. And then morantang, which means thanks very much.
I've got one more question over here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how about this lady standing up here? Yeah.
Laura from Harlan, Michigan. What authors do you enjoy reading?
Oh, what authors do I enjoy reading? Well, I learned to read when I was 3 years old, and I'm 62 now, so I have dozens and dozens of favorite authors. If you go on my website, though, under the link called Resources, there's something called the Methadone List. And this is a list of books that I recommend to people who say, well, what am I supposed to read while I'm waiting for your next book? And it's a wide variety of genres, but there are all authors that I particularly like and that I can recommend without reservation. So there'll be something in there that you like. Thanks very much. Well, I think we have come to the end of our time for tonight. Thank you.
That was Diana Gabaldon at the National Writers Series, talking with Deb Leonard. Gabaldon is the author of the Outlander series, a TV show based on the books that premieres August 9th on Starz. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For IPR, I'm Linnea Melcarrick.